Will feature socializing and ice breaking. The meetings will begin Saturday morning, and Sunday is tentatively scheduled to be workshops, skill shares, open discussions in the morning, and weather permitting, a beach trip in the afternoon. Bunch of anarchists go to the beach. Food will be provided by Food Not Bombs for the whole weekend. I believe that they wanted you to register before, but being anarchists, they'll let you come anyway. But you do need to find out more information. Visit bamboston.org, BAAMBoston.org.
And Grassroots International, U.S. friends and of MST and allies invite you for an event with Ana Justo from the Brazilian Landless Workers Movement, the MST. The gathering will happen at Encuentro 5, 33 Harrison Avenue in Boston, Chinatown, on July 8th at 6 p.m. Ana Justo is a longtime leader of Brazil's Landless Workers Movement, or MST, the largest social movement in Latin America with 1.5 million members. The MST struggles for land reform, access to health care, schools, organic production and infrastructure by promoting ground-up sustainable development based in the needs of all Brazilians. Hmm. Again, that's July 8th, 6 p.m. at Encuentro 5.
Yeah, that could be good. I think that will be good.
Yes.
All right. Next Friday evening, Scott Hamann, a 29-year-old filmmaker from Portland, Maine, will speak about his film of the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. Hamann was documenting the Gaza Freedom Flotilla when it was attacked by Israeli Navy commandos. Hamann will speak about his personal experience on the flotilla, the illegality of Israel's actions, his detainment in prison, and the brutality of the Israeli police and Navy that he witnessed firsthand. Despite soldiers' efforts to confiscate all media taken by flotilla passengers, he was able to smuggle out his video footage of the raid, which he'll show next Friday night, starting at 7 p.m. at Calvary Church, 300 Mass Ave in Arlington. This is sponsored by United for Justice with Peace Palestine Task Force and Code Pink Greater Boston.
And the Answer Coalition is organizing an East Coast protest against anti-immigrant racism to be held next Saturday, July 10th, while Arizona Governor Jan Brewer attends the annual meeting of the National Governors Association. Answer has now opened a full-time office at Encuentro 5 in Boston to prepare for this demonstration. Volunteers are needed to help organize and publicize the event every day from now through July 10th. For more information, email boston@answercoalition.org or call 857-334-5084.
And we've run out of time again. How does that always happen? What have I been doing here? It's an hour that goes by so quick. If you can't remember, like me, what I've been playing in the past hour, you can go to our website, wmbr.org, and first of all, you can look at the playlist and find out more details about what it was that you've heard, and you can listen to the whole thing again if you so choose, and or you can just wait till next week. Just you wait till next week. But now we make room for Music for Human Beings. They'll be up in just a few moments. So settle in for another hour of great entertainment here at WMBR in Cambridge. I believe you may burn the flag this weekend if you so choose, because it's America. You're free here. Good night.
marhaban. Yes, marhaban bikum. Fee music for human. I am a doctor, Jalis Sakran, and I welcome you. I am here, and how delightful the sugar of existence is. How sweet. I am fortunate once again to join you this evening across from a bevy of friends, acquaintances, and people that I do not know. We welcome first among them Aurora, vocal specialist. Welcome, Aurora.
Thank you for having me on the show today. It is so wonderful to be here.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us, Aurora.
And truly is the existence so sweet, like the natural stevia sugars.
Why sugars? Why are they so sweet?
They engage in the delightful bursts of certain inputs in our tongues. And if you look at the sugar, actually it is quite crystalline. It has such a beautiful periodic structure, which resonates with our taste buds in a delightful fashion.
So it is like the sound which we enjoy. It's all about electronics.
And about waves. And yet there are certain parts of our body which do not resonate so delightfully with sugar.
Well, many parts of my body resonate delightfully to be here with you. And also, of course, with Professor Levine. Professor Levine, mystic Jewish professor, welcome.
Hello, it is such a great relief and pleasure to be back again in my home. My home being with you and all the listeners and my fellow co-hosts here. And I should just comment that I've always found brown sugar to be the most excellent of all the sugars. And somehow it just has this taste and allure that is far beyond that of refined white sugar, and I never understood why.
It involves deeper complexities which appeal to those parts of your body which do not like the simple crystalline structure.
So my body seems to prefer complex structures which it can break down.
Yes, and actually this is an interesting phenomenon among Semitic people. They tend to enjoy the more complex tastes, while I believe this has something to do with their struggles in the past. Accessing those parts of their past which have been in the desert and who have been sieged for so long, so many years, that they yearn for a more complex existence.
Yes, I've always felt a deep longing for the Fertile Crescent.
Now, I too have deep longings for complexity, and this deep longing is answered by having a third guest with us today. We welcome Master Ojik. Master Ojik, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be on this show. I can't wait until we get to talk about some of the other topics that you're going to bring up. I hope that we can all be rich in life, health, and energy.
And this wealth, I really love that you bring up wealth in this sense, because I understand, Master Ojik, that your specialty is in economics. And when I think of economics, it is about money. But instantly this idea becomes clear, this thought, which is that one, by giving money in charity, does not lose wealth, because he is gaining, converting one wealth into another wealth. He is converting this tangible gold or bills or coins into a sort of a spiritual wealth.
That is exactly right. It is not about money at all. It is about happiness. It is about how do you feel and relate with the world around you and everybody around you. You know, it's easy to quantify money. It's maybe a little bit difficult to quantify happiness. And so the real question is, how do we make an exchange rate between money and happiness? That is really the bleeding edge of economics today.
And also this idea that one may consider, if we regard money in a classical sense, like one would consider energy, it is lost with every transaction. But if one incorporates spiritual health, then wealth may be gained or lost. But one may imagine two impoverished persons exchanging gold, and one says to the other, "Oh, my brother, you are in need of this money to buy food," and he gives the money to his homeless and impoverished friend, who returns the money with the same thought, and they exchange the money until they both perish due to starvation. But the wealth, the spiritual wealth that has been gained, has been multiplied many times.
Well, and this is also a question that I have had in my mind for a very long time. When we discuss spiritual happiness in terms of numbers, but those around us who are spiritually happy can induce spiritual happiness in ourselves without losing any of their own. And so I believe it is difficult to have an exchange rate, but more an induction rate.
Well, I myself have studied physics a little in my youth, and I enjoyed physics for a very long time until we came to this supposed law, the conservation of energy and matter. And that's when I felt that I had had enough, because I knew that love itself is not conserved. Love can increase. There is no finite bound on the amount of love and spiritual health in the universe.
This is interesting, Professor Levine, but I believe there is a love reservoir, and that we can only dip our sticks into the love reservoir.
Well, there may be a reservoir, so to speak, of love, but I believe that this is an infinite reservoir, and we can all dip as many sticks as we'd like into this reservoir without any depletion.
This analogy, I think that there may be a love reservoir, but one may dip a spoon or alternately a needle into the ocean of the love reservoir, the universal love reservoir, and one may be taking no less than the knowledge of a single drop of love from the reservoir, which may be collected by a needle.
And this is such a beautiful analogy to me. As one who visits the ocean may know, that when you swim in the ocean, you can feel the ocean and you can understand it. And when you leave the ocean, you only take a small part of it with yourself, perhaps in sand trapped in your undergarments. But at the same time, that knowledge of the ocean, that feeling of it, remains with you.
Sometimes the crab also can get trapped in the undergarments, but be that as it may, I often think of this metaphor as a really great template for meditation. I'll close my eyes and I'll imagine all the love in the universe, all the infinite amount of potential love and goodwill stored in this huge ocean of love water. And then I'll take off my socks and dip my toe into the love water. Just, you know, wiggle it around in there, feel the love in my toe, and then slowly disrobe and submerge myself within the love water. And then I feel the rays of the sun on my body, enclosed in the love water, in the love ocean, and I feel just the infinite love of the universe coursing through me. And I find this to be a really great way to meditate and to restore one's optimism and spiritual health?
Well, as always, the show is not about us spraying you with our love water. It is about mingling and joining together and celebrating universal love water. So if you'd like to call in and to mingle with us, the number is 617-253-8810. Caller, marhaban.
Hello.
Welcome, caller.
Hi, I was interested in your metaphor about the ocean and taking some ocean back with you. I think the draw to the ocean is that the human body is made of like 95% seawater. And when one goes near the ocean to the beach and absorbs the vibes of the waves hitting the shore and the salty air, it's like coming home to the cauldron where life first began, the oceans.
So there is a primal draw back to the
primal
ocean.
Yes, primal, primordial draw. It's interesting that the Latin word for ocean is mare, which is the same word, similar word to mother, the Latin for mother.
That is interesting also.
Well, and
yeah,
you are spot on here with this, because as we all know, our very first existence as creatures were when we diverged slightly from the salt water and then diverged more and more. And I believe the more we diverged, the less enclosed and unhappy we felt, the less satisfied we were with our divergence and our existence.
I also want to mention that what you first started off the show about stevia, the sweetener that supposedly has the sugar atomic structure or something, like Splenda, I guess. So, I hate to say this, but Sunday, July 4th on the Esplanade, the Boston Pops annual concert for patriotism and love of America has chosen Toby Keith as a featured act. Now, that seems like artificial sweetener and patriotism, because considering Toby Keith's reputation as being reactionary, pro-war, and bigoted, so I think they selected an artificial sweetener for the 4th of July rather than real sweetness, which is true patriotism, which means love of the world first and not just one's nation state.
No, and I completely buy into that. I think that, in general, it is just as it is easier for one to eat a food which is... It is easy to eat a chocolate bar, and it is sweet, and you feel very wonderful for a moment. But to eat turkey or to eat meat, something substantial, something that will actually help you grow, it is more work, but enjoyable in another way. And later on, you also feel better. There is more health.
Yes, well, Dr. Samuel Johnson, a famous British philosopher, I guess he lived at the turn of the 1900s, he made a comment. He said, patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel. It's kind of metaphysical and philosophical. He was a philosopher, of course. I know you value philosophy on your program.
Yeah, we certainly do, and I think more than anything, though, we value this idea of alternate beliefs and this idea that anything can be questioned, and I feel a little danger when this changes, when I feel that no longer is it safe to ask certain questions or to say certain things.
And I am so happy with what you are saying to us, caller. I believe that so many of us have learned in our youth to become cookies, and we have these cookie cutters, which are primary school, which stamp us out into these forms, and it is often difficult to break away from that and to form more educated, more beliefs that are in tune with the earth and in tune with everything around us. And I'm glad that you are sharing your feelings.
You know, cookies are also something on computers that makes it easier to visit websites and stuff, cookies and the Internet Explorer box. Well, cookies also slow your computer down. If you have too many cookies, too many tracking cookies, whatever, from alien websites, it slowed down your computer's performance, so...
Well, and this is exactly like your digestion.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to go back to this question of connecting to our primordial roots with the ocean. And I know that often people will look at chimpanzees and they'll see the reflection of humanity in the face of the chimp or the ape because they are such close relatives to us. They're really close cousins. But personally, I feel greater satisfaction when I look back and find our deeper roots. So I can look in the eye of the fish and say, wow, this is closer to our origin than the monkey. And I see the fish's face blinking back at me, and I blink at it, and I feel a strong connection to our root, to our past. And lately I've been also looking under the microscope at bacteria, and I took this one step further, and I looked at that bacteria, that blob of matter, and I just felt, wow, that was me, I don't know, 100 million years ago or so.
Well, and it is still part of you.
And actually... see, again, Professor Levine, I think there is an acceptance here of the canonical story. I recently saw a map of the Earth where the South and North Pole were reversed. And there is something very strange. The world is barely recognizable when it is reversed. And yet there is nothing unnatural. There is no reason that we have chosen north to correspond with up. And likewise here, we think of the fish as our origin. But it is equally possible that we are the origin and some group of us retreated into the ocean and became a fish.
That's true. It could be possible, but I remember something looking at gestation of the human embryo inside the mother's uterus. If you chase the origin of the human embryo to a full-grown baby, one stage of the embryo's growth, the embryo has gills.
Yes, they do say that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny.
So basically, the start of the human, all of us, from one cell, one egg, to one cell creature, we started as evolving for 9 months to a multifaceted, multi-celled, complex organism, is traces the pace of evolution.
And
it's a mirror image. It's a microcosm of the evolution of life.
There are so many examples of this also in the embryo. For example, we all begin as women. And this goes back to the asexuality, the single gender of, or the lack of gender, I must say, of creatures before they diverged into two sexual counterparts.
That's a good point, too.
But see, to me, it is not a mirroring, but perhaps there is this loss is reversed so that it is easier to regress than to advance. So our ancestors... as opposed to the canonical view where our ancestors were mindless and had no connection, no spiritual life, that they perhaps were spiritually brilliant. Let's bring a second voice on to join us. Again, if anyone would like to call, it is 617-253-8810. Caller, welcome. Caller?
I'm still here. First caller is still here.
Is the second caller also there?
Yes. Yeah.
Welcome, caller.
I have to completely disagree with what you just said. I think it's much harder to regress than it is to move forward. Sometimes there's just no going back. Like, if you fit a triangle or you your head through a railing the right way, you can't get it out. Because your neck doesn't fit into your head the right way.
Well, caller, to extend this analogy, if you were to stick your head in a railing, it is much easier to explode the railing than to pull your head through. But when you explode the railing, it is no more. It is in its previous state of a non-railing.
And that's really what we're doing with everything, with oil, with sunlight. We take it and we turn it into... some good stuff, which is the head coming out of the railing, and then a whole bunch of waste, which is railing splinters. And that's really, you know, the more we hone our world, the more splinters we have piling up.
See, now my view on this is that the railing itself is questionable. It is a questionable spiritual point because the tree itself originally is a post in a fence. So why destroy the tree to make a fence? If you'd like a fence, several trees.
Well, what if there were just two trees growing close to each other and you put your head through that, you know?
It is possible, but I'm pointing out there is a lack. You could have a self-healing growing fence.
And you could also entwine it with grasses which are growing from the ground.
Did you ever try using, as a kid, the toy you got in the Cracker Jack box, the Chinese handcuffs? You put both your forefingers into them and you pull and you can't get loose. But if you let go, relax the tension, your fingers slip out easily. So that's like philosophical. The more you're trapped, the more you try to untrap yourself through exertion.
Through brute force,
spirit and body, the more you trap yourself. When you become passive and let things be, then you are free from the handcuffs and from the burdens.
And relaxing in the railing incident would be the equivalent of knowing that you're just going to die of starving to death because you can't put your face in your food again.
Well, but the point
is good in some sense.
The point is to reach out to your spiritual and mental abilities rather than a pure physical jerk.
Jerk?
Well, and I think this point about a spiritual trap is an important one. I think it is very possible to be caught in a mind trap. And then where can one escape? Who is the one to guide you out?
Well, there's a movie about that, right? Where Lindsay Lohan played both herself and her sister, and they trapped their parents in the basement for a while, and they didn't let them out until they all got back together. And I think they went out for a barbecue afterwards.
Well, making the conversation a little more general, going back to this question of whether we are progressing or regressing, I often wonder this myself about the state of humanity, the spiritual state of humanity. Are we progressing? Is there more average love per person now than there was, say, 100, 200, 300 years ago? And I'm not always sure. Sometimes I think war now and death is more powerful than it used to be.
Well, actually, there's a lot less war than there was even 50 years ago, but you know, in the Paleolithic age, there was a war always going on with someone. Unless you were extremely isolated, there was always some sort of bloodshed, and about 40% of males in a Neolithic society would die before they reached the age of 30 from death from another man, from warfare.
I question the whole idea of progressing versus regressing. They may be more similar than what we think. If you think of somebody walking forward, you can clearly see what is in front of you. But do we really know what's going to happen next year? That's moving forward. Mm. What we really see is what's behind us. We can see our past history clearly, but not our future. So our future is really maybe looking backwards in one sense.
That is beautiful. And I think there is a language cue there also, that there are languages where the future is behind us, which is a different thing.
And one possibility is simply to walk backwards so that your future is behind you.
Precisely.
But this also brings into question what exactly we mean when we say regressing. The idea of walking backwards, are we walking backwards into a pit or into a lush valley with plenty of berries and geese?
Well, I guess we don't know. That's the beauty of walking backwards.
Well,
unless you have a mirror in front of you.
Backwards could be good, because I remember that song about Woodstock by Joni Mitchell. We got to get ourselves back to the Garden of Eden, or the Garden of Primordial Bliss, of where humanity started before something mysteriously went wrong in human history. Or we ended up to where we are today. But back to the origins of humanity, it was possibly a paradise on Earth. if you believe the ancient writings of all religions.
Well, yes, caller, and it is a popular view. It, in every culture, there is this view of loss. But I do wonder if we do not consider what we have gained. I at one point regarded the work of a philosopher who believed that at some future point the universe would begin to roll backward, and he regarded this as a great thing, that we humanity would advance to become more and more spiritual, and all of the villains of history would become great heroes, and how this was a great thing, that for example Hitler would resurrect many people and then return to Austria and then disappear, and that all people would return into their mothers, who would return into their mothers, until we became a glorious whole, a single being.
Well, but then Mother Teresa, on the flip side, would be turning all of these well-off people into abject misery and poor conditions.
And this was precisely my objection, that all of these great figures throughout history, the people that we loved, Santa Claus, would simply every Christmas, who would go into a chimney, steal all of the child's favorite toys, and then go to the North Pole where they were destroyed.
That's kind of a scary thing if you're under 5 years old.
Well, going back to the origin, St. Nicholas, he would steal dowries from impoverished women.
Yeah, so I was going to say something about the rectification of the world's problems through people regressing or whatever. I read an article on the computer last month that, according to the dichotomy, antimatter and matter both destroy each other. So theoretically, we should be living in a vacuum. But the only thing that scientists who worked on this antimatter-matter dichotomy found out was that there's slightly more matter in the universe than there's antimatter. That's why we exist.
Well,
it's a wonderful thing that you bring this up, because antimatter is simply matter that is moving backwards in time, and so this ties beautifully with the idea of regression.
But to me, Matt McCullough, if it is so, I mean, could it not be that in the universe we would have pockets of matter and areas of antimatter? And because the same argument that says that the whole of the universe should be filled with the same thing would mean that even now, even in a belief that we were exploded matter, that the whole universe would be filled homogeneously with gas.
Well, perhaps there is a sort of matter-antimatter saran wrap.
Well, myself discovered this strange issue where I would weigh myself on the scale, and I would usually weigh around 200, 250 pounds, although in appearance I'm quite slim, and I didn't understand this for a very long time until I had some radiological testing done, and it turns out that most of my mass is actually antimatter. So while I weigh very much, I appear as a quite slim person.
Well, okay.
Well, once again, if anyone would like to join in, the number is 617-253-8810. Caller, marhaban. Caller?
Yeah, hi. This is Scott from Cambridge.
Welcome, Scott.
Hi, how are you? Question about antimatter. In some way, that's not on an atomic level.
Why is that, caller?
No, is it on...
Certainly,
caller. It's on a particle level, actually, if you go beneath the atom.
But Aurora, if an entire atom's particles, all the subnuclear particles, were created from antimatter, so positrons revolving around...
Yes, but then you could have an antimatter soda pop, for example, and the point I was making is that the base, the formation of antimatter, lies in the subatomic particles, in the electrons and positrons.
Precisely.
Okay, that I understand. That that on an atomic level, there's some particle that exists as a space in some way. But how would that actually be regressive in time?
Well, caller, if I may, the theory I believe is that one may imagine if one considers a single particle in space to be traveling through time, then each particle is like a string. So one may imagine connected all of the positions of the electron through time, then one would have a line if the particle never moved, and with bends in the line whenever the particle moved. Is that clear, caller?
And so, yes, that's a little bit more clearer that the actual movement, it wouldn't be decay?
No, not decay, but simply a line or a curve through space. And then if one could imagine that this curve could bend back on itself, then at some point in time, there would be three copies of this particle, two headed in forward through time and one coming backward through time.
So what do you think of the notion that some philosopher scientists have said that the human being is a microcosm of the universe at large? We have all the elements of the universe in our bodies, and we even have cells and electrons and protons and atoms in our cells, cellular structure, that could be looked at as many, many solar systems. They revolve around the nucleus, just like the sun revolves, the Earth revolves around the sun. So basically, some people have gotten really far out there and said that it's a microcosm to a macrocosm. Inside every atom is a mini universe. And the universe we see now through astronomers' telescopes is merely a part of someone else's thumb or eyelash or whatever.
My question that I've always asked is, all these scientists come up with all these little particles, but where does love come in? How is love conveyed between two beings? Is there some particle which conveys love in the same way we have gravitrons which convey gravity? I believe there must be. And I often wonder if perhaps, as you mentioned, if this world is one little microcosm of some other little particle in some other world, is this universe a particle of love or is it a particle of gravity?
Well, one could argue theologically that love is what put the universe into motion. If you have if you personify the notion of God, which most major religions do, personify God as a grand person, not a human person, but a person that's motivated by love. So, what all that exists, the human being, nature, the natural world, rocks, mountains, atoms, neutrons, electrons, protons, all initiated by the love of the prime force.
These are all sort of manifestations of the true essence of love.
Yes, I think that's a good point.
So then the
so going backward, God would be a little bit older than the other significant force.
Well, he has a very white beard, so I would imagine he's fairly old.
And I'd like to point out to all of us here that misery, or the feeling of abandonment, is also born out of love, in the same idea that if you do not feel those sad feelings, if you do not endure them and go through them, you cannot understand the great, awesome nature of love.
So the yin and the yang.
Love is also an energy, you know. It is an attraction. It is a force. An attractive force, you know.
And we just
hate is a repelling force.
Now, do New Age economists study love transactions and how love sort of flows through the network of human relations?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there is essentially a market of love out there, and it's not a zero-sum game. It is one that you can grow as quickly as you want, and it's really quite amazing.
I like this this view of the universe that the caller proposed. So it makes me think that there is only one particle or one object in the universe, which is a love unit. And all of the love units in different arrangements or vibrations, by moving the love unit, that one may arrange all of the different and various particles which we see. When one takes a drink of water, one is drinking a certain arrangement of love units. And when one later urinates, one is emitting a similar but vaguely different arrangement of the same units, reducing all of existence, therefore, to this single particle. And I think also this gives us this idea that the universe and the person is the same because they are made of the same particle.
Perhaps this is the origin of materialism.
Well, I've heard said, I don't know who said this, but the love is the adhesive of the universe. It holds the universe together.
It is the universe glue on.
Well, so what is gravity itself just some sort of simple physical form of love itself? I mean, gravity, of course, is the attraction of mass for mass. And I wonder if that's some way of expressing this idea that we want really to be together. And perhaps, I mean, the Big Bang occurred and we're now to some degree drifting apart, but eventually we'll come back.
Well, let's bring one of our separated particles back together with us. The number is 617-253-8810. Welcome back, O separated particle.
Oh, bork, 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 bork.
And this is a particle that I remember. Bork, welcome.
Meow.
I think this is the first call. I think I know who this particle is.
And what would you call it, first caller?
My name is Martin Luther King, and people called me Bad.
I think he's this person is actually a very well-known figure. He remains anonymous, of course, for the radio, but he's a very well-known figure around the Metro Boston area.
Well, indeed, Bork, thank you for joining us.
Bork-a-doodle-doo!
It is great when we have minor celebrities who anonymously call us. Of course, we know who this person is, but we, of course, respect his desire to remain anonymous.
And understand it perfectly. It is a game, a mental sleight of hand here, a small trick also which can bind and dazzle.
It just goes to show you that the theorem bore fruit, because our discussion initiated this celebrity to be drawn to the telephone and drawn to join our little discussion group here.
And the noises being made are, of course, an interesting vocal expression. I believe it is not one that the caller, him or herself, is exuding, but...
Well, it is an interesting exercise to go into a room, preferably a soundproofed room, where no one can possibly hear what noises you make, and to just experiment with your vocal cords, see what range of possible sounds these vocal cords are capable of producing. We don't normally stretch them in that way. We just talk and we sing. We don't realize what kind of wondrous noises and sounds we can make and how we can express ourselves in very unusual ways.
Well, exactly, and this sort of, the idea of going into a room where no one can hear you is quite good, as we are always somewhat ashamed of the noises we can make, and we limit ourselves to such a small range out of some feeling that we must be appropriate.
I want to ask the new caller what your take is on...
Excuse me, I'm not nude. Dude,
they don't know about that.
New caller,
I said new caller, meaning the most recent caller to the line here. What's your take is on this as you listen to it quite intently past half an hour?
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening.
Okay, I guess you weren't listening intently then.
I think
you're listening unintently.
Perhaps was
mad. No, I mean I wasn't listening to you right now.
Yeah, I heard the show. It rocked.
Thank you, caller. Were you listening using the radio or meditating and connecting psychedelically with us?
I was using high-frequency vegetable patch, demultiplexed.
We do advocate multiplexing here very much.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, but I know. But to squeeze it through one of the final stages at my end, it has to be deplexed.
Certainly, I think too many people also they try to commune with us simplex in a single channel, and it can be enjoyed. We can still connect, but it is a certainly different experience. And I appreciate that you also chose to spread it back towards us.
This is not the radio station where you should use your telephone and your radio at the same time.
That is correct, caller, indeed.
Well, of course, in modern art movements, there has been a sort of return to minimalist structures over the past century. And I think, to some degree, this is sort of a single channel where we can have multiple channels, but sometimes the complexity overwhelms us and we don't appreciate the intrinsic value of something until we reduce it to its utter simplicity. So I think sometimes a single channel communication can be quite interesting.
And I love and I welcome the natural and primal expression that you make, and I feel all of us have that in us, as Aurora mentions, but we constrain ourselves. So I think it would be nice if for a moment we all released the various noises. All of us may choose for briefly these noises and let us celebrate this now, please, everyone. Excellent. And
how freer we feel now.
One of our callers is not done.
Please constrain yourself, caller. Restrain yourself.
Laughter is a noise, a human noise too. I peed myself a little. Anyway, I think I better go, and I want to. Is the show go to 8 o'clock, or what time is this?
Indeed, for merely another 11 minutes.
All right. Well, I can listen to the rest of the show on my radio, and then turn the Red Sox game on, see what kind of philosophical problems they develop playing their opponent.
Thank you for being with us for this millionth of a century, caller.
Thank you, caller.
Thank you for having the program.
Thank you also. It is so wonderful to be part of and to have been part of a moment like that.
And
with,
I hope
with
that,
others.
That you listeners, even those who are shy of calling in physically, were able to take part in that and to feel it open your mind and open your soul.
Precisely. I mean, we did not invite you specifically to do so, but I think many people did. I feel also sometimes that I commune with the many people who are listening now, and also with those who are listening in the future, which is possible now.
I find that I commune with those who are not listening sometimes as well. I can just sort of, I imagine some man in China watering his garden, totally unaware of the existence of this radio program. And yet I somehow, there's some spiritual path through the air that I made, that I connected with him. And I don't think he even realizes it, but he feels it anyway. He feels some connection that I've made. Mm-hmm. And somehow some thoughts about the world have entered his mind that are somehow related to what we've talked about.
And if anyone would like to connect with us in a more oral way, they may do so for the briefest of times. The number is 617-253-8810, and we would love to end the hour with you. But this idea of the love economy, Master Ojek, is an intriguing one indeed. I wonder if it is possible to... It must be to have loss in the economy. As you say, it is not zero sum. The love may be produced from seemingly nothing, simply from the movement of things. And likewise, I believe it must be destructible, similarly.
It absolutely is. I mean, you just take this program. You know, if the balance in your bank changes, do you feel different? But even listening for the 60 minutes or 45 minutes, you feel it. You know there's been a change. And like I said, the science behind this is, how do we quantify that?
Is it quantifiable, really? Or is it a thing that is still studied really qualitatively? Are there devices that can measure?
You know, it's difficult to quantify, and that is the whole point of New Age economics, is that we are on the bleeding edge of trying to quantify this, because I think you can say that there is a certain quality to it, but
could
we
you
haven't
just
figured out
sort
the
of
answers.
measure the size of your smile and how frequently you smile throughout the day, perhaps?
Actually, a few studies have already done that, and we can quantify it in that terms, but how do you do this at a national level? How do you run a nation or country or a world by the number of smiles? It's a little bit more difficult.
I think you need to fit smile sensors on every citizen.
Well, of course, this is also a difficult issue, as some people you would have to normalize for them throughout their lives. Some people tend to smile constantly, even when they feel misery within themselves. And some people barely smile at all, even when they are a beacon of happiness.
So perhaps the smiling is not appropriate, but other measurements can be made. And I think classical economists face similar difficulties, but the New Age economists, the recent work, if I may speak out of turn, Master Ojek, on this, is that there are miniature love economies that are created and then studied externally. But I believe there are casualties. It is a risky experiment to run because there are losses.
That's true, and I once on this social networking website called Facebook, I decided to experiment a little with trying to sort of distribute love throughout a social network. And I so merely posted some loving comments on my profile, and I watched as their effect trickled throughout my friends. And at first, this was great. Many of my friends seemed happier because of this little love bomb that I had sort of planted in my social network. And I noticed love was spreading. Some of my friends were getting married. But then I realized that at least three of my friends, in a very indirect way, actually got divorced as a result of my seeding, my love bomb. It somehow had this perverse effect. And I think that's really where we need to study these things. We need to understand how love percolates throughout a network and a population.
Yeah, there is a whole moral and ethical aspect of is it safe to be doing these experiments when we don't really know the long-term effects of them?
I mean, love itself is sort of a poison of the brain, I think, in some sense. I mean, it's a good poison. It's the kind of poison you'd love to die from, but nevertheless, I mean... stable human functioning requires that we not constantly be in the throes of ecstasy.
Which also can be a dangerous thing.
Well, it's interesting because I've noticed that those clients of mine with extreme levels of stress and unhappiness always had difficulty with bowel movements. So perhaps frequency of bowel movements would be one way to quantitize one's happiness. And quality of life.
And that would be easy to measure, I suppose. You could just outfoot every toilet with a sensor.
Sort of a handprint recognition.
And to measure simply the total quantities that are emitted. That is interesting also.
And the variation by region, you might notice, oh, this neighborhood is a particularly happy neighborhood with very healthy bowel movements, and this other neighborhood within the city is perhaps a particularly unhealthy neighborhood with unhappiness.
See, this would have wonderful implications in the real estate market, and it would also encourage us to eat healthier foods with more fiber, less Big Macs.
And it could be, I think, also incorporated as part of the census. It's another possibility. These ideas about various movements, it's really making clear to me, alas, once again, that the hour is so close to being over, and I struggle every time with the end. I'm not sure why these flows must occur, but they do constantly. There are endings, there is flowings, things.
Well, movement itself, of course, is essential to human happiness. We need to move, we need to get on with our lives.
But there is a voiding, a generation of a void, and the creation of extra dense space, if only brief. So thank you all for joining me in this extra dense space. Thank you, Aurora.
Namaste.
And also Professor Levine.
Thank you for having me.
And the newcomer, Master Ojik.
Thank you.
Thank you to the many callers who joined us, and those we apologize to those who we could not commune with using direct sound. I'm Dr. Jalis Sakran here on Music for Human, WMBR Cambridge 88.1 FM. I am Dr. Jalis Sakran. We are on every Friday at 7 p.m. Stay tuned for Kennedy Compound. مع السلامة.
Safety.
Number one,
cars and bikes stop at red lights.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two,
look first before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first, and bicyclists, stay out of the door zone.
Number three,
cross with the signal.
You are safest if you wait for a walk or green traffic signal.
Don't jaywalk. That's just walking into trouble.
Number four,
cars and bikes should stop for pedestrians and unsignalized crosswalks.
Be nice. Be legal. Be safe.
Brought to you as a public service by the Cambridge Bicycle Committee and this station.
This is WMBR 88.1 in Cambridge, broadcasting live from the historic Walker Memorial Building and streaming on the web at wmbr.org. This is Hipster Happy Hour.